This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ed Murphy is an astronomer at the University of Virginia, and he joins me live in studio. It's good to see you.
It's nice to see you.
How's your summer going?
It's been very, very busy.
Are you teaching this summer?
No, I wasn't. I was supervising a number of summer students. I was part of Brooks Pate in the chemistry department, had a big program for summer students to come in from smaller colleges and universities who don't get the opportunity to do research, and they came here to UVA. So I was helping with those 10 students.
Oh, terrific.
And then we also ran a big workshop for teachers. Randy Bell in the Curry School and I had a big workshop for 26 teachers on teaching science and the nature of science, and that was a few weeks ago. And then I just got back from the Boy Scout Jamboree.
Where was this?
That was up at Fort A.P. Hill.
Yeah, yeah.
In Caroline County.
Yeah.
So it was 35,000 scouts and 8,000 adults, and I did the astronomy merit badge for 10 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it was great.
You see a lot of the kids getting really interested in this at a young age? I mean, I know I was. I always have been. But.
Yeah, you know, it's a great way. We have the telescopes out, and so hundreds upon hundreds of them come by and just look through the telescopes. And those that get really interested could actually sit down and work on the astronomy merit badge.
Yeah.
And in fact, I've already heard from one father whose son went to the astronomy merit badge. He gave me a call the other day to say that just sitting there doing the merit badge for 3 hours, his son came home and said, I have to find every book on astronomy I can. I want to be an astronomer. So, you know,
You got one, Ed.
That's right. I did my good turn that day.
There you go. That's great. Ah, that's terrific. Now, we have a lot we want to talk about today. You're going to give us a full update on all things space. Let's start, though, with the show tonight, right?
That's right. And, well, the next few nights. There are two big things going on over the next few nights in the night sky. The first one is the one that we have a few days to see, which is there's a beautiful grouping of three bright planets in the western sky right now, right after it gets dark. So if you go out about 8:45, 9 o'clock, maybe closer to 9 o'clock once it's darker, you'll see brilliant Venus up there in the west. Very easy. You can't mistake it for anything else. It's by far the brightest star-like object up there in the sky right now. But just above Venus, making a little triangle with Venus, are Mars and Saturn. And so there's this beautiful little triangle of the three planets up there.
Yeah, and you can see Venus.
So you see Venus. Mars is to the upper left of Venus, and Saturn is to the upper right of Venus. And the easiest way to find them is hold your arm out at arm's length and hold two fingers out. And it's about two finger widths to the upper right and a little bit more than that to the upper left. And so Saturn to the upper right, Mars to the upper left.
So Mars, Venus, and Saturn in the western sky tonight around 8:45 or 9 o'clock.
That's right. And that'll be like that for the next few nights. And so you have about a week or so to see them nice and tightly grouped up there.
Why is it that Venus is so darn bright?
It's bright for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that it comes closer to us than any other planet in the solar system. So, and it's quite close to us right now. In its orbit around the sun, it's coming between the Earth and the sun right now. So it's very, very close to us. But the other reason is that it's completely covered in clouds. Unlike a lot of the other planets, Mars, for example, which has covered a rocky surface that has hardly any clouds on it, Venus, we can't see the rocks down on the surface at all. It's complete clouds, and clouds are an excellent reflector of sunlight. So Venus looks extremely bright because it's close and very reflective.
So Venus is closer than Mars?
Oh, yes, when it's at its closest, that's right.
Really? So have we ever sent anything to Venus to I guess you can't really land there, it would melt, wouldn't it?
No, the Russians have landed on the surface, and the United States accidentally landed on the surface. And so the Russians have sent a number of probes to intentionally land on the surface, and they've survived for roughly an hour down on the surface of Venus, up at 900 degrees or more sitting there on the surface. It's a terrible environment to try and envision a spacecraft lasting a long time, but the spacecraft can land, it can get the cameras deployed, take pictures of its surroundings, and then overheat. So
there are pictures then of the surface of Venus.
That's right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, the Russians did this back in the late 70s, early 80s, landed a number of probes on the surface
really?
Of Venus. That's right.
Does it look like Mars?
Actually, it looks more like lava flows on Earth. There are huge lava flows on Earth. If you think about the big island of Hawaii, in fact, it's nothing but giant lava flows. The whole island is made of lava flows, and it looks like that without all the vegetation.
Wow. And there's just no life at all. I mean,
it's much too hot. There's no liquid water on the surface because the temperature's so high it would boil away.
Yeah, amazing.
And then the United States has put a probe, Magellan, that went into orbit around Venus and used radar to completely map the surface of Venus.
Yeah. Any big notable mountains or anything like that? Or is it just flat lava flows everywhere?
You know, it's got lava flows. I think what Venus is probably most notable for are the giant volcanoes on the surface of Venus. It has very large volcanoes, very similar to large volcanoes that we find here on Earth.
Wow. We're talking with Ed Murphy, an astronomer at the University of Virginia, joins us every few weeks to keep us updated about all things space. And the phone lines are open if you got a question at 977-1070. So tonight in the western sky, look for Venus. Mars is up to the left of it. Saturn is up to the right of it.
Right of it.
And it'll be that way for a few days.
Exactly.
As I guess Saturn will drop.
That's right.
The next couple weeks.
Over the next few weeks, Saturn gets lower and lower every night till it finally disappears into the glare of sunset. Venus and Mars will be up there a little bit longer, but they'll be gone by early September.
Yeah. Now, there is another show going on in the night sky over the next few nights as well, right?
That's right. And this is the big show for the next few nights, which is the annual Perseid meteor shower, which I think is the best of the summertime showers and probably the second best of all the meteor showers during the year.
And so what are the details on that?
So the way to see the Perseid meteor showers, if you can get away from city lights, that's ideal. If you can't get away from city lights, you'll see some from your backyard. You need to go outside, but keep in mind that the Perseids don't really start up until 11 o'clock in the evening, and they're at their best about 2 or 3 in the morning. So it is a late night shower.
Have you ever done that, Ed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen the Perseids many times staying up, but I can say with the Perseids, I've probably never stayed up all the way till sunrise. By 2 or 3, after you've seen 100 or 200, they all start to look the same,
right.
and the bed looks awfully comfortable.
Right. So after 11, starting when? Tonight or tomorrow?
Tonight. You could do it tonight. Tomorrow night, it'll probably be a little better than tonight, but the next two nights are the two prime nights for observing it.
And where do we look?
So after 11 o'clock, you can just first of all, you don't need a telescope or binoculars to see a meteor shower, because really all they do is they limit your field of view. They limit what you can see in the sky down to a little tiny spot. And the odds of a meteor shooting through that little spot's infinitesimally small. So you really just want your naked eyes.
Yeah.
You can lay out in a lawn chair or a sleeping bag, face towards the northeast, look about halfway up in the sky, and you'll see these meteors shooting through the sky, sometimes called shooting stars. But of course, they have nothing at all to do with stars. They're little tiny particles of rock and ice and dust that are burning up in our atmosphere as they're traveling about 18 miles per second when they hit the atmosphere.
Now, are we going through the tail of something? Is that why
this
is happening?
It's an old comet, Swift-Tuttle. This comet, as it goes around the sun, when it comes close to the sunlight heats the comet up. The ice melts away. It goes right from a solid into a gas. And in the process, it liberates little tiny particles of rock and dust that are also in the comet. And they stay in the same orbit that the comet was in. And once a year, in the case of the Perseids, the Earth passes through this trail of debris that's been left behind by the comet.
There you go. How is it that the thing can keep going? You would think that after a while, wouldn't the sun melt all of it away?
Eventually, that does happen to comets. So comets aren't permanent features. As they come in and a little bit melts every time, eventually, after thousands of passes around the sun, these comets may completely evaporate and disappear.
So tonight, definitely tomorrow night, after 11, but into the wee hours of the middle of the night,
that's
are the
right.
best times for the Perseid meteor shower. And again, is this what part of the sky do we look at?
So face towards the northeast and just look about halfway up in the sky. If you're up in the wee hours of the morning, 2 or 3, you probably want to look more high overhead than halfway up.
There you go. Good stuff. And that's tonight is Venus, Saturn, and Mars in the western sky. And tonight, and definitely tomorrow night, after 11, the Perseid meteor. Let's rejoin our conversation with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. So what's this about? Was it an accident on the space station, or something broke?
Something broke on the space station. So I wouldn't call it an accident so much as a routine maintenance failure. If you think about, people often think of space as being very cold. And the problem with your spacecraft, though, is that all those electronics and people and everything else generate a lot of heat. And if you think about it, they're in a giant can with all their computers and everything else, and this heat can build up very quickly, so you need to get that heat out of the spacecraft and radiate it away into space. And the way it's done on the space station is with giant ammonia coolers. They use ammonia as the coolant. They use pumps to pump this ammonia around, and primarily it's used to draw the heat out of the electronics that are outside of the space station, like the big power supplies and things that generate power for the station. And they have two separate cooling systems they call them the side A and the side B loops that each cool the station, but you've got a backup in case one breaks. And On July 31st, the big giant ammonia pump that pumps ammonia through the system failed. And this is a major failure because the other loop can still keep the space station cool, but they still had to power down a lot of electronics to make sure that things wouldn't overheat. So they've had to shut down a lot of the science that they were able to do. Obviously, you can't shut down life support, so the science modules are mostly what gets shut down. And then you're operating in a case with no backup, no redundancy. If that other loop were to fail, then they would be in serious trouble.
Would they cook? I mean, what would happen to them?
Well, they'd have to leave. I mean, if the other loop failed and they couldn't get it going right away, I don't know exactly what the time frame would be, probably within a day or so, they'd probably end up having to abandon ship and leave until they could get things straightened out, probably come home and then have to straighten it out later.
So what, did they get out there and try to fix this
so
thing?
On Saturday, they had a spacewalk to go out and take the pump off. Fortunately, this is such an important component that there are actually four spares on the outside of the space station already attached out there for them. So they just had to go out and get one of these spare pumps, which are actually quite large, and switch it into place. And as they had the big spacewalk last Saturday to begin that process, and as they did that, one of the ammonia lines that was connected to this pump sprung a leak. And this is a problem for a couple of reasons, one of which is if all the ammonia leaks out, then they're in trouble because that's their coolant.
Then you have no coolant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the other problem is that as the astronauts are working on it, if their spacesuits become contaminated with this ammonia, when they come into the station, they can be poisoned by the ammonia. So they had to plug it back in right away to keep it from leaking too much. And they abandoned the spacewalk at that point, came back in, did a decontamination procedure to make sure there was no ammonia. And then they had to work out a solution. And the solution that they had come up with was today, this morning, to do a spacewalk that would isolate that leak and then go out, detach that line, move the old pump out of the way. And on a spacewalk coming up this Sunday, they'll move the new pump in and hook it up. And hopefully everything will work fine after that.
Goodness gracious. How many people are in that thing right now?
There's six up there right now, three Americans and three Russians.
How long have they been there for a long time?
They've been there for varying amounts of time. So a couple of them have been up there, if I remember right, it's about 4 months now.
Don't the Russians like leave their people up there for years?
Not anymore. So the Russians have the human endurance record in space. The longest person that's ever been in space has been over 400 days. But the Russians don't do that anymore. They subscribe to the current policy, which is about 6 months in space is the longest that we let people spend.
Doesn't it make you sick if you stay up too long, like your bones break or something? Or
your body feels that it no longer needs the bones because there are no stresses on it. And so it starts pulling the calcium out of the bones and your bones start getting brittle and thinner. And that's a very difficult thing to build up when you come back.
What happened to the Russian who was up there for 400 days?
You know, he's
still in bed?
No, he's not still in bed, but he will never be normal again. He's when you go up for 6 months, it takes a fair bit of physical rehabilitation, exercising when you come back to get back to where you were before. But the indications are after 6 months, you're back to normal. But in his case, he's probably not going to get back to normal. He's not going to get the bone density back that he had before.
Really?
Yeah.
That's sad.
It is, but it's you know, he knew going into it what the risks were.
Yeah.
All
that. Let's rejoin our conversation with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. Joins us on occasion every few weeks to keep us updated about all things space. So the United States has one more mission with space shuttle. Is that right?
Two more missions.
Two more missions. Okay.
On the books. And Congress has passed or ordered NASA to have a third mission, but it hasn't been approved yet. But it looks like there will probably be three more missions left in the space shuttle program.
And then we scrap it. And have they decided where those things are going yet?
No.
Or are there people still lobbying?
People are still lobbying. They were supposed to have made the announcement a few weeks ago as to where the space shuttles were going after retirement, which museums would get them. We know that Discovery is supposed to go to the Smithsonian. But other than that, it's still up in the air as to where Endeavour and Atlantis will go. And NASA announced that they're putting off that decision because of Congress's decision to fund a third mission, a third remaining mission.
And why are they doing that?
Congress is doing it primarily, I think, to keep the workforce in Florida employed. There's a lot of concern about the thousands of people who are employed at the Kennedy Space Center and cutting those jobs and losing those jobs. And so I think that's one of the primary drivers is to keep those people employed longer and to have this extra mission. Now, we have the hardware to do it. They've built the giant external tank, and they've got the parts there because the goal had been for each of the remaining two shuttle missions was to have enough spare parts that you could launch an emergency mission to go rescue the astronauts if need be. But they're going to use all these spare parts on that remaining mission. And in that case, they're going to have to send up a much reduced crew so that if there's an emergency, we know there's no hope for launching a space shuttle because there's no longer any fuel tanks or solid rocket boosters that are built to do it. So they'll have to be rescued by the Russians.
We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy, but at some point, those folks in Florida, they're going to have to let them go, right?
They'll have to let them go because as of right now, this last mission of the shuttle, if the president approves the budget that Congress, both the House and the Senate have passed as it is, it'll fly in June of 2011.
And then that's it.
And then that will be the last shuttle flight.
So then what happens to space exploration? Are we finally going to move to robots?
It's up in the air.
I mean,
right
we've
now.
Talked about that so many times, yep. and you've said it. That just makes sense. I mean, even the casual observer would say that makes so much sense that you get more bang for your buck by sending a robot.
And that's what makes sense to me. And in fact, one of the wonderful things I think about right now is to just think about all the robots that we have exploring the solar system. But in the case of the U.S. human spaceflight program, its future is very unclear right now. There was under President Obama, there was a big push to have commercialization of space. Have a number of these commercial firms build rockets and space capsules that could launch astronauts to the International Space Station for us. And he wanted to fund that with $6 billion, and that has been cut way back by Congress. And Congress is ordering NASA to develop a big, giant, heavy-lift rocket that could lift very large payloads into space with the goal of possibly sending astronauts to an asteroid sometime in the 2030s, probably.
Huh.
And continuing the development of this capsule that that NASA had been working on called the Orion capsule that would go on these rockets that NASA is no longer going to develop. So to me, the human spaceflight program in the United States is in chaos right now. It's not clear what's going to happen. It's clear that the administration and Congress aren't seeing eye to eye on this, and it's just going to take more time to hash out what the future will be.
We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. Now, you mentioned all the robots that are out exploring space. We want to get an update on those. But before we do, what's going on with the sun?
So the sun is finally coming back to life, you could say. The sun goes through an 11-year cycle called the solar cycle. And at the peak of the cycle, the sun will often have a dozen or more sunspots on it. And in the at solar minimum, when it's hardly active at all, you can go many weeks with no sunspots at all. And in 2008, the sun had reached solar minimum, and astronomers had expected by that 2009 it would start coming back up to maximum so that in late 2010, 2011, we'd be at solar maximum again with lots of sunspots. But the sun surprised us, and in 2008 it was at minimum, and then in 2009 it sunk even deeper into minimum and went many months with no sunspots on the surface and showed no signs of activity or reviving in this 11-year cycle.
And what is a sunspot, and what makes it happen, and why should we be concerned about them?
Well, sunspots are big magnetic storms on the surface of the sun, and they're places where the sun's magnetic field is poking up through the surface of the sun, and those spots are able to cool off, radiate their heat into space, but that magnetic field prevents them from getting as hot as the rest of the surface of the sun. That's not to say that they're cold. They're actually about 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit, so in the surface of the sun's about 10,000 degrees. So they look black because they're cooler than the rest of the sun, but still hot by our standards.
And how do they mess with us in any way?
Really big sunspots have been known to be involved in huge solar flares where the sun can fling off a large number of particles. And as these particles strike the Earth, they can have a number of effects. Today, the primary concern would be all of our communication satellites that are in orbit around the Earth. These communication satellites, the electronics on board, the computers could be fried if a very large flare were to strike the Earth.
Huh. So we're not seeing sunspots right now on the sun.
It just started up again. So within the last few months, we've been seeing more and more spots on the sun. And over the last few weeks, it seems like the sun has really picked up in its activity. So it seems like now it's headed towards a solar maximum sometime in 2012.
And have we seen this in other stars? I mean, do we know that this is just something suns do?
We know that we've seen lots of activity like this on other stars. I think one of the good things about our sun compared to other, especially younger stars, is that our sun seems to be relatively quiet. There are some stars of the same type as our sun, just much younger than our sun, that are very much more active. And in fact, it would be hard to envision a life a planet around one of these stars that would have life on it, because it would be constantly being hit by these giant solar flares.
So we're lucky then.
So we're lucky that our sun seems to be a quieter than average star. Now, that may be the fact that it's in middle age compared to some of these. Mostly we see this activity in younger stars.
Interesting. We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy here at about 19 minutes in front of the hour of 6 o'clock. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now, News Radio 1070 WINA. So the robots that are exploring space, there's a bunch of them that are out there, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. There's, you know, roughly a dozen major missions going on throughout the solar system right now that people don't think about on a daily basis.
But, and you know, this is one of my favorite topics, because
yeah,
I always email you, where are these things?
Yeah, that's
you know?
Right.
Because they make big fanfare when we launch them, and then we sort of forget about them.
That's right. And then when they're doing something interesting and they return some data or some fantastic pictures, we hear about them again. But we forget that in some cases, like at least one of the rovers on Mars, it is every day marching across the surface of Mars,
amazing,
sending back new pictures.
So let's do the list here. You know, what's out there and what's the latest on them?
Well, you know, so we're starting on the inner solar system. We have a probe that's on its way to Mercury right now called MESSENGER, and it will end up at Mercury in 2011. And we'll go into orbit around the planet, and we'll spend a couple years studying the surface of Mercury. On Venus right now, the Europeans have a probe in orbit around Venus, studying the atmosphere of Venus and studying the surface. We have a major probe in orbit around the moon right now called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that is completely mapping the surface of the moon, returning the best images that we've ever had of the surface of the moon from space. We have lots going on Mars right now, a major orbiter in orbit around Mars, two rovers down on the surface, another rover that's being built, getting ready for launch next year.
As big as the two that
bigger,
everybody knows
actually
about?
Actually bigger. So the two that we know about, Spirit and Opportunity, about the size of a golf cart. This new one's the size of a compact car.
Really?
It's called the Mars Science Laboratory. It'll be launched next year.
Wow, that's exciting.
It is. It's a really exciting mission.
Now, what will it be able to do that these other two can't?
So it's science is much more capable, and first of all, it's being designed to last a full year on the surface of Mars, as opposed to the two rovers that were only designed to last 90 days. Of course, they've lasted much longer than that. So the hope is this one will last longer. One of the goals is to operate at night. The two current rovers are operated by solar power, so this one can't operate on solar power if you want it to run during the night. So it carries a nuclear reactor with it. It's powered by a nuclear power supply. And it's got much more capable scientific instruments on it, better cameras than the two current rovers. And I think the neatest thing of all that's on board is right now with the two rovers we have, if scientists are interested in a rock, they literally have to drive over to it. The rover has to go up to it. It has to place its instruments on the rock, drill into the rock a little bit, and then sit there while the instruments analyze what the rock is made of. This new rover has a laser. We'll literally shoot the rock from a distance, analyze the vapor that's given off, and be able to tell the scientists from a distance whether that rock is worth going to study up close. And if it is, then they can go over, drill into it, take that sample inside the rover, analyze it in detail. But if they decide from a distance it's not interesting, they can just move on to the next one.
Yeah. So what about Spirit and Opportunity? What are they doing?
So Opportunity is driving across the surface of Mars right now. It's on its way towards a giant crater by the name of Endeavour. It's about 13.7 miles across, the size of the crater. It just left about a year ago. About 2 years ago, it left Victoria Crater on Mars, which was a much smaller crater, about half a mile across. And it is literally just every day driving a little bit across the surface of Mars. The total driving distance will end up being about 10 miles to get from Victoria to Endeavour. And it's going to take altogether a couple years. So it's probably another year from now, maybe a bit longer before it gets there.
A couple years to go 10 miles?
Yep. And the reason in part is that the rovers are driven much slower than your car. The other reason is that scientists always find interesting things to study along the way. Something that people often point out about the Apollo programs is that the rovers still haven't gone as far as the longest drive that astronauts did on the moon. But the longest drive that astronauts did on the moon is they literally knew before they landed what interesting feature they were going to see. And they had to drive past all these other interesting features because with the limited oxygen supply, you just can't stop and enjoy the scenery and look at every interesting thing. You have to get to your target, get the job done, and get home before your oxygen runs out. But with Opportunity, every interesting thing that scientists see, they can stop and study it along the way because everything tells us a little bit more about the surface of Mars. With a robot, you don't have to pass up the interesting things to get to your target. because you're not limited by an oxygen supply.
If you just joined us, we're talking with University of Virginia astronomer Ed Murphy. It's 14 minutes in front of 6 o'clock. So what about Opportunity?
That's Opportunity.
Spirit, yeah. Is that the one with the bum leg?
Yeah, Spirit, well, it's got two bum wheels on board, and there's some sad news about Spirit. We haven't heard from it since March 22nd, and this was in part expected. What happened with Spirit with its two bad wheels, it got stuck in the sand, and when it got stuck in the sand, they couldn't get it up on a slope so that it could point its solar rays at the sun. And this is important during winter on Mars when the sun gets very low in the sky. The days, like our days in the winter, are not very long. That means the solar rays can't recharge the batteries as much. So they used to like to park the rover on a slope that would face towards the sun. But being stuck in the sand as it was, they couldn't do that. And so when winter came, they knew the rover wouldn't have enough solar energy to keep its batteries charged. So they put it in hibernation. And the hope is that sometime this fall, we'll hear back from Spirit, that it'll call home and say, I survived the winter. What do you want me to do?
I wouldn't want to be the NASA employee who was driving that day at the joystick and got that thing stuck, because you know they all know who that guy is.
But they don't, because the beautiful thing about the rovers in large part is that they're autonomous. The scientists say that's the rock we want to study, and the rover figures out how to get there. And the reason is that when it's at its closest, it takes a few minutes for radio signals to go from Earth to Mars and back again. When it's at its farthest, it can take 20 minutes. So imagine as you're driving home tonight, trying to figure out when to turn the car 20 minutes before you actually have to make the turn, because that's how long it would take your signal to get out there. So you can't drive the rovers from Earth. You can tell them where to go and what to do, but the Spirit and Opportunity have enough intelligence built in that you can tell them that we're interested in this rock over here, and they can figure out how to get there on their own.
So when does this big new car-sized rover go to Mars? Next year?
So it'll launch next year.
Do we know, is it summer or?
I believe it'll launch in the summer of next year.
Is it going to be like the other rovers where it'll land in those big inflatable, that big ball and bounce around for a while?
The airbags. No, it's too heavy for the airbags. And so they have an even more ingenious, but at the same time, I look at the video of this thing and I think it's a frightening thing. They're calling it the air crane that... It will hover above the surface, and it will lower the rover down on a cable. And then when the rover touches the ground, it'll cut the cable, and it'll fly off and crash a few hundred yards away. It's a really, if there's videos on the NASA webpage, on the Jet Propulsion Lab webpage of this thing coming in. It's really remarkable that we can build a machine to do this, but they have a lot of confidence that it will work.
Doesn't it just blow your mind? I mean, it's just like we live in such an age of science fiction reality.
Yep.
You know?
I mean, the Mars rovers, the two we have now, take pictures better than the ones I take on a family vacation. So they take these pictures and you realize you're looking at the surface of Mars, a picture that no one has ever seen before, and it's better than what I do with my digital camera on vacation.
Ed Murphy is an astronomer at the University of Virginia, and he joins us on this program every few weeks to talk a little space news. So more robots are out there. That's Mars.
That's right.
But keep moving out in space.
So outward in the asteroid belt, we have a mission right now that it's on its way out to visit the two largest asteroids in the solar system, Vesta and Ceres. And it's supposed to arrive there about a year from now, and it will spend about a year studying Vesta. And then once it's studied Vesta, mapped the surface, it will move on to Ceres. And these are both minor planets in the solar system, or dwarf planets as we would call them today. They're both the two biggest asteroids. Ceres is the largest asteroid in the solar system, about 600 miles across, and Vesta is somewhat smaller than that. And it will study both of these as being examples of the two biggest asteroids. And then out further than that, we have the Cassini orbiter that's in orbit around Saturn right now that every few months just returns just absolutely amazing and spectacular photographs of Saturn and its rings and its moons. And we're studying learning a tremendous amount about the Saturn system.
Is this the one that flew through the volcanoes shoots water out into space?
Exactly. So Saturn's moon Enceladus has these stripes on the bottom of it, these cracks in the surface where water is venting out into space. And in fact, it just recently had another one of these passes where it passed right through this water plume coming off this moon, this icy moon of Saturn.
That's amazing.
It is. It's amazing that we live in an age where we can do this.
So, but there's still more out there,
there's
right?
Still more out
we're
there.
Voyager's way out there.
And
right?
The next step out beyond Cassini is about twice as far from the sun, a little less than twice as far from the sun as Cassini is the Pluto Kuiper Express. It's the mission that we launched back in 2006. It's on its way out to visit Pluto. It will get there in July of 2015. It just recently passed the halfway mark to Pluto. And so it's going to take another 5 years before it finally gets out there to where Pluto is.
And is that solar powered or it's nuclear?
No, that's nuclear powered. Because once you head to the outer solar system, certainly once you get past Mars, sunlight is too weak to have a solar powered spacecraft.
Yeah.
So, but then beyond Pluto. And beyond Pluto, we have four spacecraft out there, only two of which are still operating. There's Pioneer 10 and 11, which are both of those are no longer operational. And then there's Voyager 1 and 2, which are still operational.
They went up in the 70s, right?
1977, yeah. Voyager 1, which is the most distant of the two, was launched in September of 1977.
And so where are these things and what are they doing?
So Voyager 1 right now is about 114 times further from the sun than we are. And Pluto is about 39 times further from the sun than we are. So this is out there about 2.5 times the distance that Pluto is from the sun. And it's studying the boundary between the wind from our sun and the gas between the stars called the interstellar medium. And Voyager 1 is passing through that boundary right now and allowing us to study that boundary.
Yeah, and you've been on a previous show here where we listened to audio of that it's sent back of the sound of the solar wind.
That's right, as it sweeps past the spacecraft. Yeah. And eventually that solar wind, as it moves out in the solar system, collides with the gas between the stars, and it comes to a screeching halt when it collides with that gas, and it creates a shock. And that's where Voyager 1 is now. It's passing through that region where the wind is slowing down, and eventually it will pass through that region where the wind comes to a stop. And when we pass through that shock, mankind will, for the first time, truly be able to say we've left the solar system.
Wow. Now, for folks who don't know the solar wind, if you could explain that, because sure. I think a lot of people were raised to believe that the sun just sits in space and the planets go around it and right. may not realize that the sun is actually shooting through space.
The sun is moving through space, but the solar wind is just particles that the sun is throwing off. The surface is 10,000 degrees, so those particles on the surface of the sun are moving quite fast. Up above the surface, it's actually much hotter than that. The surface of the sun, the outer thin atmosphere of the sun called the corona, can have a temperature of 1 or 2 million degrees. And those particles, in some cases, are moving so fast that they just escape from the sun altogether and never come back. Now, it sounds like the sun would be losing mass over time, but this wind is a very, very tiny fraction of the mass of the sun. It's very, very small. But it's significant enough that we can measure this wind coming out from the sun.
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Now, before we run out of time, folks have been emailing me saying, I got some email about Mars. Make sure you ask Ed Murphy about this. Lots of inboxes are filling up with something about Mars.
That's right. Lots of people are getting this email message from friends and family and people who mean well about it to tell you that on August 27th, you should go out and take a look at Mars in the night sky because through some interaction with the gravity of Jupiter, Mars will be closer to Earth than average. And if you read it very carefully, or if you don't read it very carefully, you'll see that it even says that Mars will appear huge in the sky, and it's just not true. The important thing to know is that it's just an internet email hoax that's running around.
So, but there is some truth to it. Like years ago, Mars was real close, right?
In August of 2003, Mars was closer to the Earth than it had been in 60,000 years, and closer to the Earth than it would be for another 200 years. But that was August 2003, and the important thing to know back then is that Mars never appeared as big as the full moon in the sky. At its closest back then, Mars still looked just like a bright reddish-orange star in the sky. It never gets very big.
But people are getting this email, and they're passing it around. They're
thinking this
is a real thing.
That's right. It's a very well-put-together PowerPoint presentation that has all these slides about Mars and what to go out and what to look for. And I'm afraid it comes back every August since 2003.
Really?
Yeah, somebody does is they take this PowerPoint presentation and they change the date, and then they start sending it out to friends and family, and they send it out to people. So if you get this email message about Mars being bigger than normal in August 2007 or 2010, just ignore the email. It's not going to be bigger than this. Don't worry. You're not going to miss anything by not going outside. But if somebody does send it to you, I think you can write back to them and say, look, it's a hoax. Don't spread this around anymore. And someday, hopefully, it'll reach the status of these email scams that we all get about making $5 million sending me your bank account.
Right.
And we now know that that's a scam, and hopefully this will die someday, but it's been going strong for 7 years now.
Amazing. And folks can always go to Snopes.com. That's a good email hoax website.
If you're
curious about an email, you go to Snopes.com and check it out. You can find out there if it's for real.
Yeah, especially Ed Murphy, if it sounds too good to be true.
Ed Murphy, an astronomer at the University of Virginia. Ed, I can't thank you enough. Just fantastic stuff.
Thank you, astronauts.
Your shower.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.